Hey, this is in your best interest. I'm Philipp Müller. Today, I'm joined by Anthony Arthur. He's the head of iShares Asia ex-Japan Wealth Distribution at BlackRock. And I'm also joined by Freddie Lim, co-founder and chief investment officer at Stashaway. They're both here on this episode talking with me about ETFs, short for exchange-traded funds. Some of the topics discussed were the beginnings of how ETFs came to life, and how one would choose an ETF over another by considering attributes such as its exposure to different geographies, its structure, and liquidity, just to name a few. I hope you enjoy it, and if you do, be sure to subscribe and consider leaving us a review and sharing it with your friends. Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of In Your Best Interest. Today we have a fantastic topic to chat about, and I got two fantastic guests with me as well. Today we will be talking about ETFs, that stands for Exchange Traded Funds. It's an investment vehicle that's gaining a lot of steam across Asia as well, after already being very successful in the other parts of the world. And for that topic, I have with us today, again, our Chief Investment Officer, Freddie Lim, who is obviously quite knowledgeable in that space as well. At Stashaway, we also make use of ETFs in our portfolios. So, hey, Freddie, good to have you back.
It's my pleasure to be here. Hello.
Good to have you. And from outside of Stashaway, we have actually joined us by someone from BlackRock. His name is Anthony Arthur. He's the head of Asia ex Japan Wealth for APAC at iShares, which is the ETF side of things from BlackRock.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, no, it's really good to have you. So we're really looking forward to for that discussion, because I think, you know, especially in Asia, the topics of ETFs are still emerging. You know, we usually get a lot of questions about it. I personally as well, from friends, having lived in the US for 10 years almost, and seeing the rise there since the financial crisis pretty much, has been fantastic to see, because it gives a lot of people access to low cost investment products with great diversification, which we will dive in here throughout the webinar, I mean. So how about we'll do that, Anthony. Get some people that come on the podcast. We like to not interview you, but we would like to get a little bit more background knowledge, because I think people are always super interested to learn more about our guests. We get some younger audience as well that look up to people. Hey, what path should I take, you know, after university or the first few jobs that they have? So just to give the audience a little bit of a background, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe where you grew up, where you went to university? Did you study finance maybe?
Sure. So I'm actually from the UK. I grew up in London. I went to London University, though I did have a spell outside London in a boarding school in Yorkshire, which is in the very north of England. I moved to Asia in 2012, and you know, started working with BlackRock not long after that. I actually didn't study finance. I studied ancient history.
Oh, wow.
Which was quite a niche degree, but you know, it stood me in good stead. And I think the lesson from that is, you know, the you pick up skills through studying a degree, which are not necessarily purely based just on the content that you learn.
No, absolutely. Was there anything that sparked your interest through studying, or maybe early on in life already to then get into finance? Or, you know, because I actually, when I did my first internship at an asset manager during university, there was actually a lot of investment banking analysts there. They all came from a lot of the liberal arts schools in the US, right? So they also, history was a lot of times actually the major that they studied, but they ended up in finance, right? There was some people were pretty straightforward. They said, hey, this is where the money is, kind of thing, right? Others were, you know, inspired by maybe people they grew up with. For you, when did you make that decision to say, oh, I want to go into finance?
So I actually started out in, working for a communications agency that looked at consumer goods. And I kind of got a little bit frustrated with the the depth, or I felt that there wasn't enough depth in that. And at the same time, a friend of mine, who, as you say, is a liberal arts student, he had a first in English, became a fund manager. So it was through talking to him, I sort of thought, this is the sector that I want to be in, and I made the shift a couple of months later.
Okay, no, super. Yeah, see, this is always interesting to see. But I think it shows, again, Freddie, right, that, you know, no path is always just the straightforward one that you plan for when you go into college, right? We had it with you, the other guests before as well, right? It kind of shows that you just navigate the circumstances.
I have to second the observation. When I first started at Lehman Brothers back in the year 2000, a lot of guys were like Harvard Law School or Art School or Political Science. None of them are doing quantitative finance, right?
Yeah, no, but I asked them when I started the internship. I was like, okay, why did they get hired? You know, why did they? But obviously, they went to mostly was Ivy League schools, right? So people knew they were smart, they can do math, right? And I think a lot of times the hiring managers, they just went with, you know, the smarts, and people are being, obviously they have to be good at, you know, studying and stuff to get into these schools, right? So I think they just saw the talent, and then they made them all get their CFAs, usually. And that's where they're devil, and then on the job training, right? So this was usually the case. But good, no, thanks. Thanks, Anthony, for giving us that that overview. One other question that I always like to ask is, what is the best investment you ever had? You ever made, sorry.
Actually, I was just thinking about this the other day, actually. I invested in a sustainable fund when I did my first pension selection at the very start of my career, which was early 2000s.
Oh, wow. That's early on for sustainable funds.
Yeah. And actually, I had a client that did sustainable investing at the time. And, you know, the fund itself has been okay in performance terms. But, what I like about that is that I just think sustainable investing is going to be like recycling. It's the new normal. It's what everyone will do eventually. And you know, we saw there's some research out recently, actually, by Nordea, the Swedish bank, where they said that if you moved your savings into sustainable funds, it would be 27 times more efficient for your personal carbon footprint than eating less meat, using public transport, reducing water, and flying less, all combined. So I really think that the power of sustainable investing is enormous.
That's super interesting. That I didn't know that the number would be this big by and this should be more publicized, right? Because people want to be more sustainable in the way they live, right?
Depends on markets, right? You know, you can see in Europe, for sure, in Australia, it's taken off. And I think there's beginning to be greater awareness across Asia as well.
No, super. Yeah, super good. But you mentioned, so you used this in one of your pension funds, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I kind of want to shift over to ETFs and kind of get an overview of the history of ETFs. But when you talk about pension funds, this was the first experience I actually had with ETFs as well. It was in my first role with Morgan Stanley in a 401k plan, right? So basically the US equivalent of a pension plan where you make your own decisions. And, you know, they had like a lot of choices in terms of, you know, to invest at Morgan Stanley. And some of them were ETFs, which was the first time I really got exposed to them. But most pension funds still don't really have a lot of ETF choices, right? So it's usually still mutual funds, as far as I can tell. Do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The available selection that I could choose from in that pension plan was purely mutual funds. Some of them were trackers, but you know, they were all mutual fund rather than ETF based.
But at least they already had trackers in the early 2000s, so that's actually not too bad then.
Yeah.
Because I think like a lot of times, right, you know, it used to be also mostly managed, same for us as well. So the choices were always quite, you know, you made a choice on an investment manager versus let's say, a fund provider in that case. But yeah, but before we get into that, I do have more questions on that topic. You have been with BlackRock for quite some time. You had exposure to ETFs through them, through your own investment before. Freddie, in episode one of this podcast, talked a lot about, his exposure to that as well. So maybe both of you can talk a little bit about the history of ETFs. I think, Anthony, you will have also some, great insights from BlackRock there in terms of like, where did they come from? How long are they about? Because where I want to get here is that in Asia, they seem the new thing, right? Like still people don't know, ETFs. Like at Stashaway Academy, we actually do a seminar every few weeks. It's how to invest using ETFs, right? And we actually show people what are ETFs, what you should look out for in investing them, because it's still so new. People don't know what they are, right? People here still buy a lot of managed funds with high fees and things like that. So maybe we'll talk a little bit about the history to show them actually that they're not just the newest thing just now, right? Not the last 5 years.
Sure. Shall I go first just quickly? I mean,
yeah, sure.
There's a bit of debate on what was the first ETF, but we always say that it was 1993 and there was an ETF launched on the S&P 500, which is still around today, that fund. But really the industry, I think if you look back, the industry didn't really sort of gather steam till really after the financial crisis. In 2010, there were only 1 trillion assets held in ETFs. That number today is just under 6 trillion, even after, the sort of sell-off that we saw in March this year. So it's really, you can see a lot of that growth has come relatively recently. And I think the sort of biggest drivers for that are, costs coming down in ETF have been a huge, huge driver. In terms of what we see with Asian investors, I mean, we look at sort of Hong Kong and Singapore. We actually found that there was, a dispersion in how people use ETFs according to their age bracket. So if you are sort of under 35, those investors, much more self-directed, perhaps more comfortable. The stereotype is that they're much more comfortable looking at doing their own research on the internet. They had a much higher prevalence for ETF use than the sort of 35 to 55 bracket. And then funnily enough, and we saw this was more pronounced in Hong Kong actually, but the sort of over 55 bracket or over 60s typically invested in ETFs to a much higher proportion than their peers who are a little bit younger. And that may be because, there's the, they spend a bit more time at home doing their investments. And some of that is, perhaps ETFs are on exchanges. And, these investors are pretty comfortable trading stocks daily anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good overview. And you did mention, that one of the drivers of the growth is cost and efficiency of costs versus prior products available to retail investors, especially, right? And maybe Freddie, you want to go into this. Can you explain a little bit more about what cost means when you talk about investing in ETFs versus what else would you invest in? Let's say, for example, a unit trust or a mutual fund.
Well, we can bin count the obvious, but we also need to consider what's not on the fact sheet, right? So to start with what's visible, if you start with the expense ratios, which is what the fund managers charge for managing the funds. However, the expense ratio actually does not include any distribution charges that may or may not be there, right, with respect to a fund. But in the case of ETFs in general, there's not a lot of distribution charges outside the expense ratios, right? But you also need to look at stuff like that's taken out of your NAV, your net asset value in the fund, which comes from trading operations, how efficient an ETF is managed or not, right? A way to look at that is to see how the ETF behaves versus the underlying tracking index. And if you tend to see a white tracking error, that tends to tell you a lot of, there's a lot of other stuff going on. Either the fund manager is doing a poor job, or there's some other charges in their daily operations, right? So there's a lot of stuff outside that.
And I think that's a good question, Freddie, here, actually, a good observation that is confusing, I think, to a lot of people. And maybe, Anthony, you can chime in on this as well, as Freddie mentioned the tracking error, right? People always say, oh, before you invest in ETF, you need to look at tracking error, and not every ETF is the same. Why is there even, why should there, if something is tracking the same thing, why is there a tracking error?
Yeah,
why
sure.
is one better than the other, right? Like if I'm tracking the S&P 500 and the other ETF is supposedly tracking the ETF, the S&P 500, right? Why has one a bigger tracking error versus the other? So I think for a lot of people, that's a very confusing topic.
I think Freddie hit the nail on the head, really. It's that's a very important thing to look at, but it's also an indicator that perhaps there's more going on underneath the surface of the ETF. You know, one example might be that it could be a synthetic ETF. What do we mean by synthetic? It means that it achieves its exposure through derivatives. So if it was tracking the S&P 500, it would give you a replication of the performance of the S&P 500 instead of actually owning the underlying shares in the S&P 500 itself. So that could be one reason. And often there'll be counterparty charges and perhaps counterparty risk that you need to be aware of when you're looking in something like a synthetic ETF. Another reason might be that the ETF is trading in a different time zone to the markets that it represents. So, for example, if you were to buy an ETF that's listed in the US but is trading Asia, you know, the US market is open when Asia's asleep. So there's going to be a disconnect between when the stocks that trade within that make up the constituents of the ETF, they're trading at a different time to the ETF itself.
Well, that's also adding to what Anthony has just said. There's also reasons like the replication methods being different. For example, some asset classes are not exactly like S&P 500 where everything is reasonably liquid to own physically, right? Some funds may go for something called statistical sampling, where they don't own everything in the indices, but they sample from it in such a way that statistically get close to what the index is doing, right? And because of that approach, maybe the expense ratio can come down, but the tracking error could be widened, depending on the underlying nature of the market. So there's a lot of possibilities there.
No, that's good. I think that's a great insights there on, you know, the costs, but also that not every ETF is equal in terms of, you know, like when you're scouring for one to invest in. So we talked a little bit about, you know, where ETFs came from. You know, we talked about the costs. How else are ETFs used in today's world? Are they mostly used to you know, just say, hey, by retail investors to invest instead of a mutual fund because they see, hey, oh, the mutual fund managing US large cap equities costs me 1.5% a year, but I can just buy an ETF that costs me maybe 0.2% a year, right? Is that the only decision, or is the only, you know, use today, or is there other ways that why they make sense for people to use them?
Yeah, I think ETFs are used in multiple ways, right? I think the most obvious one is someone saying, right, I just want exposure. And we've seen that, you know, over the last couple of months, particularly where we've seen retail volumes for ETFs really spike up. And what's driven that is just people are looking at what's happening in the market and want to make a quick tactical investment and to capture, you know, what they see as possible returns in the short term. But by far and away, the biggest driver for ETF use is ETFs being used to build portfolios. So, and we see that, you know, we have, you know, clients that are asset managers where, you know, they are ostensibly delivering an actively managed product, but they're using ETFs to do so. And, you know, really, if you think about it, every time that you make a decision whether to invest in US equities or to invest in fixed income or Asian equities, each of those decisions is an active decision. But it's just that the vehicle you choose to express that decision with is a passive instrument, i.e., you know, it tracks the index as opposed to seeking to outperform it.
Yeah, so basically you're saying that, you know, even asset managers as well as retail investors, let's say they want to, you know, especially during this year, they say, okay, so everyone is working from home, technology is going to be doing well probably because people still need to use technology. Instead of then trying to figure out which company does well, they can just buy a tech sector ETF, correct?
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that's come through now is that the ability for ETFs to really drill down into a particularly niche or, you know, subsector are so much more improved than where they were a few years ago. And that's really the advent of things like big data. So you've got, you know, companies out there that can look at, you know, supply chains for companies and then build a whole sort of subsector that goes way beneath in terms of detail than the sectors that we're commonly used to for looking at how equities trade.
Yeah, Freddie. So Anthony was mentioning asset managers, right? Or, you know, fund managers making, you know, tactical choices by using ETFs for their portfolios. Maybe you want to give a little bit of an overview of why did you choose ETFs to build portfolios? And then what's your reason for allocating to certain sectors maybe?
At least for the Stashaway angle, our intelligence is in building portfolios of different asset classes and around the world. And for us, the easiest way, and the most efficient way, and the most cost-effective way to do so today remains to use ETFs to do so. But there are also other situations where it's not necessarily better with ETFs, right? It could be with a unit trust as well. So we are actually quite agnostic in that respect, but it just so happens today, by the numbers, right, by the expense ratio, by the tracking error, by the kind of offering, there's so many choices that's out there with ETFs now, that we felt compelled to use them. So that's the first thing I want to first clarify, right? Other than that, really, in our case, we are just interested in the tracking ones. We are not interested in smart beta or some of those that's AI driven. We also like physical. We do not like synthetics. We do not like leverage. We do not like inverse. We do not like ETNs, which is the bond note disguised like an ETF with extra counterparty risk, right? So we are quite selective, actually, even though we use ETFs in general. So it's not like all ETFs are made equal, and I think users and audiences should always do a bit more homework. Obviously, we have the likes of the big players like BlackRock and a few other counterparts that have a strong track record of managing ETFs for so long, right? So the reputation of the fund managers come into the consideration as well. So I would say a lot has come in between us and the regulators on how we use it. That the primary use is to just track the asset classes we want to track to construct those very diversified portfolios for Stashaway clients.
Yeah, and you just mentioned diversification again, right? I think we learned earlier on that, you know, in the evolution and the way ETFs have come about, they can really help diversify people's portfolios, right? Maybe Anthony, can you give us a little bit of a rundown of the benefits for diversification in portfolios for, you know, even retail as well as asset managers, and why ETFs are helpful for that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, diversification has the old cliche with it that, you know, it's the only free lunch in investing. But what that means really is that investors should hold multiple sources of return in their portfolios. And you know, that's going to mitigate the risk that if one source of return, say, be it US equities, doesn't perform, the rest of your portfolio, you know, is perhaps shielded from some of that risk and can still deliver a performance when, you know, one asset class does not perform. So it should smooth out some sort of element of volatility in your portfolio. How do ETFs help that? Well, the obvious and most basic level is that, you know, the ETF is holds multiple stocks or bonds inside it. So you straight away have some benefit of diversification just by holding an ETF, because you're not then exposed to, let's say, single security risk. And then the next layer of diversification benefit is where you stitch multiple ETFs together to give you access to those different sources of return.
No, perfect. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, Freddie, this is kind of what you alluded to that you're doing with portfolios for Stashaway clients as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. You need multiple pockets of return. And I know psychologically is for an investor, when you log into your account, you look at line by line, right? And there tend to be this psychology barrier where you say, hey, why is this line item not making money?
Yes.
Everything else is up, right?
We always see this, right? Like, oh, how long people were upset about gold positions, right? Or certain bond position, but then volatility starts picking up, right?
Yes. And I remember in our first major reoptimization, a change in our portfolio allocations back in December 2017, the markets were doing very well that year. Emerging markets were up 40+%. Technology is the same. And Stashaway has to go out there at the end of the year and say, I'm buying a lot of gold. And people's first response was, this is not going to make return. This is not going to make income. What's wrong with you, right? And that was when gold prices were 12,000 and no, 1,242. We are now talking about 1,700, right? So it's easy to look at the line items and forget the value, the value that resides in something elsewhere other than return. It provides you with that portfolio insurance in case something extreme happens tomorrow that you do not expect, right?
Yeah, and I think this is true throughout time, right? I have so many friends that always come to me and say, hey, why don't I can just buy the S&P 500. And just let it grow for the next 30 years, right? Why do I need a, you know, diversified portfolio and buy all kinds of different ETFs that I then have to move around and things like that? What I always ask them then is, hey, if your portfolio is down 40-50%, like in 2008, will you still be able to hold on to that one ETF that you bought, right? That is now down that much. No, but this is how, you just have to make people, you know, aware, right? Or because that's the worst possible moment in time to sell, right? So if you're happy with it and you hold it for 30 years, yeah, go ahead, buy that ETF. This is what Warren Buffett always says as well. Yeah, just buy the S&P 500 for life, right? But holding throughout that time is where, you know, investor psychology kicks in. And I think having that diversified portfolio, you know, and the way Freddie has said, you know, that asset class sometimes are down, they work in other ways, right? To ensure your portfolio a little bit as well is super, super important.
Well, ultimately, it comes down to the users, the investors, the risk profile. And I mean, if your risk profile, it happens to be exactly the same as the S&P 500, maybe it's easier for you to just go and buy an ETF that tracks the S&P 500. But in most cases, most of us are not, right?
No, I've seen too many after the financial crisis, first drop, where people are, you know, calling in crying just before retirement because their accounts are down 40-50%, right? So obviously, a lot of people, especially after like 10 years of bull market, right? People are just like, they don't look back. They don't remember how bad it was, right? So I think people like evaluation of your risk and, you know, your goals in life that you always preach, Freddie, is quite important for that.
Absolutely.
So we'll talk about a little bit of the diversification now of ETFs, right? And I think, you know, people, you know, can do some more research, but I think, you know, a lot of the pros that we talked about around ETFs are there. Anthony mentioned earlier, you can also get tracking mutual funds or tracking unit trusts, and you did as well, Freddie, right? That you don't completely say, hey, we would never do that, invest in those. So what are some of the pros and cons then between ETFs and mutual funds / unit trusts, especially, you know, maybe they're also just tracking an index, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, mutual funds and ETFs do have something in common, and that's that they're both open-ended. So what I mean by that is that, you know, as more investors want to invest in the fund, be that a mutual fund or an ETF, that fund can keep expanding. It's not constrained in size. But where they differ is that ETFs are liquid and tradable during the day because they're listed on exchange. And it's that point of access, really, that really sets ETFs apart. So investors can access the investments that they want as markets are open. Whereas it might take some time to subscribe or to sell a mutual fund holding. And, you know, it could be that you want to make a position in one day and sell it. You can and sell it in the same day. You can do that in an ETF. Or if you wanted to buy something and hold it for the longer term. But the other sort of most fundamental difference is, for the most part, the vast majority of ETFs are passive instruments where they just seek to give the performance of, or they seek to track an index, whereas typically mutual funds are managed investments where they seek to outperform a particular index.
Mm.
Now, there's obviously cost comes into play for that, because ETFs tend to be cheaper on a given exposure than mutual funds. And that can be a limiter for some mutual funds, because it means that not only do they have to outperform the index that they're based on, but they also have to give enough outperformance to cover the cost of that investment.
Yes, absolutely. I on that point, it raises the hurdle, the bar for the active manager to make the same return, right? And in a market where everything goes up, there's not a lot of differentiation among the different stocks and the index, then the fund manager would not perform as well as the ETF that's tracking it in a very efficient manner. All right, so this is a function of whether you get differentiation, whether, you know, things are different industries in the whole stock index, they are behaving differently, they're growing differently or not, right? So in most cases these days, we don't see a lot of differentiation. It's been there for a number of years that you see, like, in general, the market return is a majority of the return of an asset class, right? In fact, I think BlackRock had done a study on that, where you're shown that 96% of an asset class's return is actually due to the decision to allocate to it rather than to pick winners and losers. There are various numbers flying around. Some people mention it's 80%. Some people mention it's 96%. But it's a big number.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, we quote some statistics from Norges Bank. So, and that's Scandinavians again, but they're looking at their portfolio, and they you know, said actually, look, security selection is a relatively small part of the return. Yeah, it's around 90% is derived just purely from selecting which asset class to invest in.
So, Anthony, sorry that this is just came up in my thinking, that a lot of people might have questions about, because we just talked about the ETF versus mutual fund / unit trust debate and how they're managed. When you say they're tracking an index, can you maybe, because we have you on the line, say who actually manages these ETFs? Let's say I buy a iShares US equity ETF, right? And it tracks the S&P 500 index in this case, right? Does it buy, like, is it a computer program that just buys, you know, every time inflows, outflows, it just buys the 500 holdings? Or is there still a manager doing some part of the work?
There's still a manager doing part of the work. And, you know, you mentioned the S&P 500. You know, that is, you know, perhaps the easiest market to track, because, you know, the largest 500 of the largest companies in the world that have, you know, ample liquidity. And in each, you know, to make up a unit of an ETF, typically it's going to hold 500 stocks if they're all trading. Where it gets harder, and you know, Freddie mentioned this a little bit earlier, is where you might have some kind of sampling technique, is if you're tracking a market that perhaps some of the, you know, some of the stocks don't have a lot of free float. You know, there's a balance to be made between saying, do I want 99 of the stocks of an index of 100 if it's going to cost more for the fund to go looking for that extra, that last stock, and in doing so, perhaps the trading will be prohibitively expensive, and you know, be a knock on effect in the performance of the ETF.
No, I think that's a very interesting topic, right? Because I think people never really understand what is it. It's tracking something, right? But how do they actually do it? So thanks for giving some insight there. I think that will be super super helpful for people. So we talked about ETFs, why they're good, you know, how they work versus mutual funds / unit trusts. Before we get into you know, how retail investor or any kind of investor actually can get better access to ETFs, we usually get a question, and I know Freddie has a big opinion on this as well. But even it came up again, I think earlier this year, right? Michael Burry from The Big Short, even, right? From the movie and the book, famous for shorting the housing market in the crash, says there is an ETF bubble, right? People are pouring money into these passive investment vehicles, let it be open-end, closed-end, etc. And he thinks it's a bubble. You've been hearing this more and more. It comes up every once in a while from the media, right? Would you guys like to dismiss all this, or like, is there, demystify some of those concerns that people have?
Yeah, sure. And you know, you're right. It comes up from time to time, and you know, someone will make a, you know, very strong statement that then gets, you know, then spawns quite a few articles and, you know, more discussion on this point. And, you know, of course, we should look at all these, the risks in investment. But, you know, our reply to that is really a question of scale. So ETFs at the moment, equity ETFs, as of May this year, are around 4 trillion in assets. But the total equity market is around 80 trillion in assets. So there's a very small proportion of the overall is held in ETFs. And so, you know, to that point on there being a bubble, you know, no one says that about active strategies or mutual funds, which are around 20 trillion of that market in equities. So we think, based on those numbers, there's actually quite a long way to go. And you know, we've seen where I think people talk about the risk of ETFs, saying that you know, either that the ETFs are trading so much in a particular asset class that they're causing additional volatility, or that there's so much trading related to ETFs that people won't be able to, you know, exit a position because there's more trading in an ETF than there is in the underlying market. So we did some analysis on that, and if you think with an ETF needs to be to grow or reduce in size, needs to be you create or redeem units. It's what it's called, and mm-hmm. that's whereby you'd collect a basket of, you know, 500 of the S&P 500 and build a new unit. But where that's really where the ETF touches the underlying market, because that's where you need to go and find new stocks or sell stocks to break up a unit. And we found that for the S&P 500, the ETFs account for really just 3% of trading in the underlying stocks itself for the primary market, which is a relatively low proportion. And I, you know, people often raise this issue for fixed income, particularly because, you know, most bonds don't trade on exchange. They're traded over the counter. And, you know, people are often asking, well, how as a an equity like vehicle, like an ETF that trades on exchange and, you know, has daily liquidity, how does that, you know, match with an asset class that is not trading frequently like that? And look, you know, fixed income ETFs are regularly tested. But what we've found is that where we have periods of market volatility is that actually we see trading increase in fixed income ETFs. And, you know, that, and each time that trading level increases, it's with higher numbers. And we saw that again most recently in the market volatility we saw over March. You know, if ever there was a time when there was stress in fixed income markets, that was it. And, you know, ETFs were tested and, you know, we'd say that they came through that period pretty strongly and passed that test. And, you know, actually the Financial Times wrote, and they have been, a longstanding critic, that ETFs holding bonds played a key role in easing the March turmoil. So, you know, that's really a, you know, an about face by the FT on them on that topic.
Hmm. Freddie, I know you have usually lots to say on this topic as well, because you get that question quite a bit, right?
Yes. I would, adding to Anthony, I would say that why bring the smaller guy in the market for systemic risk, in the sense that global ETFs, assets under management globally, is just about $7 trillion in total. And it's probably just about 9 to 10% maximum of global assets under management, right? So you are talking about something that's smaller than the mutual fund as a whole today. It's still a lot smaller. The mutual fund industry is easily 5-6 times bigger. And hedge funds are smaller, but hedge funds can leverage easily 3 to 5 times, and their impact could be as large as ETFs, or if not bigger, right? The active trading comes, you've got to look at the underlying use. A hedge fund, if they're going to show the index, whether it's through a mutual fund or through selling the underlying, they are going to do it anyway. Whether they can use ETFs today to do so or not, they are going to short, right? Because they're active trader by nature. So I just sort of want to throw a question to Anthony as well, where is it true that in general, I know there's a lot of ETFs types, but in general, is it more passive in nature, or just sort of is not as does not attract as much active investors into it than otherwise?
Do you mean to say that people tend to hold ETFs for longer periods of time?
As a community of ETF user, can say that in the majority is still towards a tracking and a more buy and hold sort of behavior than trading?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the case. And you know, that's more, most self-evidently, that's more likely to be the case for retail investors who are looking to, you know, build a kind of a retirement solution or do something with their savings. But when we look at institutional investors, we did a survey last year, and we do it most years actually, where we survey Asian institutional investors. But now 65% of them are saying that they use ETFs for core allocations in their portfolio, i.e., you know, to build a position that they maintain for a longer period of time.
Right. I would say that there was some criticism about much on ETF, but my response would be it's simply because ETFs are more transparent with how it shares information, that we see the NAV of an ETF, for example, TLT, right? 20-year plus the US government bonds, in the peak of the liquidity pressure in March, it was trading at around 6.5 percentage point below the value of the underlying assets. But that's simply because people are getting margin call and they're selling something that's profitable and working to cash out to pay margin calls elsewhere. ETF has come true with providing the liquidity, but doing so at a discount of the fund's value versus assets. But I would counter to that and say the same would have happened if the mutual fund or unit trust would have been more transparent with real-time pricing, that they would have that discount as well. They just don't do it. That, and because we report that, that's why people are seeing the ETF being discounted, and hence ETFs are the bad boys, right? I mean, it's sort of a chicken and egg problem.
Yeah, and I think you also have to also always, in any kind of discussion, look at where the arguments are coming from, right? what's the interest of the person, you know, doing the arguments? I think it's always quite important as well. And I think, Anthony, you can maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, you know, by having, you know, easier access to investing, right? People can, you know, start investing into ETFs with, you know, low amounts of initial investment. They're cheap, they're traded on a stock exchange, so they're very easy to buy to, right? I think that gives a lot of liquidity to the market in general, right? You get access to, you know, so more and more people around the world through internet and technology and, you know, ease of use of ETFs are actually now market participants, whereas before they would, maybe it would be too much of a hassle to get started in investing. I don't have enough money, right? So all these things contribute in a positive way.
Yeah, and because of that, you know, ETF's flexibility, the sort of lower minimums and low cost, it's very easy for a retail investor to build a portfolio of ETFs with, you know, with a small amount of money, and have something that they can then add to on a sort of monthly basis, so that they can, you know, dollar cost average when markets are going down, they, you know, they bring down their average cost of their investments if they keep investing in that period.
If you're investing
for a medium to long term goal, you know, to a certain extent, you can, you're less bothered about you know, daily volatility or, you know, sort of pricing dislocations that may occur, which, you know, we have seen tend to sort of even themselves out over a couple of days trading.
Yeah, and I think this is where I wanted to shift to next. The discussion is more on, you know, the listeners and seeing how they can, you know, how they can get exposure to ETFs now that they maybe learned more about them, done their research, and then a lot of things that they need to consider before selecting an ETF. So I think we already talked about access. I think we said, hey, you can go to your local broker, you can go, you know, online, opening up accounts. It's quite easy to get access to ETFs. You can get access to an ETF strategy if you, you know, go with StashAway and, you know, what Freddie does. All of these things are, again, available to everyone now. It's, you know, StashAway, we do it. You can start with $1 if you really wanted to, right? I think at about $10 to $50, we can build your portfolio because we use fractional shares. So I think getting access to the product is easier than ever now. But if people go about and say, okay, I like that idea, it's easy to get access to, I want to invest my money, I want to move something out of other portfolios where I've been paying a high fees and I don't agree with it anymore, what are some of the key considerations, right, that they should take into account for selecting an ETF? Because we touched it early on that not all of them are equal, right, when we talked about tracking error, but are there other points that they should take into account and compare ETFs under, you know, even if they seem on the surface, they seem the same, but underneath they're not, right? That Freddie mentioned earlier. What are some of the things that they should look for before saying, hey, I'm going to with this one?
Sure. Well, I think first of all, the most important thing to look at is exposure. So if you want to get into US equities, you've got to make sure that the ETF you're buying gives you US equities and the slice of the market that you want. Secondly, structure. So we talked about the impact of synthetic, which is a derivative based ETF structures versus physical. You know, you may in that situation where you're buying synthetic, you're just introducing another level of risk because you're dependent on the counterparties for derivatives. So it's additional risk and potentially additional cost. They may be small, but they are there. Thirdly, I'd say you want to look at the domicile of an ETF and the impact on your tax situation. You know, if we typically say to investors that they in Hong Kong and Singapore that are taxable, that they should use UCITS ETFs, But having said that, you know, I know some providers have a way of buying US listed ETFs and, you know, giving back any tax on withholding.
Yeah, that's a good topic, because I think you know, for us currently we use US traded ETFs, and that question comes up quite a lot for Freddie all the time, of why is he still going, you know, with a fund that has the forced withholding tax on some form of dividends and interest, versus going with a UCITS that has a maybe a little less, right? Maybe Freddie, you want to chime in there really quickly, because that is one of the key considerations. A lot of people misunderstand that as well, right?
I think the confusion came from the fact that you are either you count the bins on the table or you don't, or you look at the bins outside the table as well. So the way we approach it is to look at all costs that's in there. So expense ratio can be higher in UCITS than the US one, if let's say they track the same thing, right? But sometimes not true. But the tracking error could be wider, or could be, you know, so we try to look at that. And also at the same time, there are optimization strategy that we built in for the US listed ones where we minimize dividend tax impact. So for example, on the bond side that we selected, the ones are all qualified under the QII. The qualified interest rule for a majority of it to be reclaimed in the financial year, and that minimizes. And on the equity side, yes, you do get those dividend taxes. So you try to focus your strategy more on reinvestment rather than on ETFs that track stuff that pays out more dividends, right? So there's some strategy that we can build in to minimize the impact. And hey, you know, it's not zero in Luxembourg or Ireland. It's 15 to 20% there on two, say, and you're talking about 30% on two in the US, and the difference of 10% on two is 0.2. And is that easily overwhelmed by wider bid offer, tracking error, or higher expense ratios? Right. So you got to count all the beans that's on the table and not on the table.
Yeah, Freddie's absolutely right. I mean, and we spend a lot of time with our clients on this, where we'll say to them, you know, you need to look at more than just the expense ratio of an ETF. And, you know, there are different components to what holding an ETF is going to cost the investor. So some of that is the expense ratio. Again, the tax is going to have an impact. And then also the bid-ask spreads, so, i.e. how liquid is that ETF, and how tightly does it trade? And if you're paying a large spread, you know, i.e. the difference between the price as you go in, plus any commission, that can add up to the total cost of what it is for an investor to hold an ETF. I'd also say, just that, you know, on selection terms, there are two other points that you should look at. One is performance, just how closely does an ETF track the benchmark that it's meant to be following, which we kind of covered off earlier.
Yep.
And then this liquidity point, which is really just plays into those, you know, the issue of bid-ask spreads and how tightly ETFs trade. That's very important to look at, because it can be quite wide on some funds.
Yeah, and I think that's where I wanted to ask Freddie another question on. I know we just talked about it for a little bit, but for example, for, you know, the listeners who are in Singapore, right, you can theoretically buy, I think there is now one or two, I can't remember exact number, you might know, of S&P 500 ETFs traded on the Singapore Stock Exchange, right? Why would you say it's still a better choice to go with a US traded one versus that one? Is it based on liquidity? Is it based on the overall cost?
It's both, actually. You tend to, I mean, a better example could be GLD, GO, mm-hmm. That's denominated in Sing dollars, and then versus the US one. The liquidity is vastly different in the two, and the US version is deep, right? So that's just an example. So you got to look at that. And we also look, in addition to what Anthony has said, we also look at the tracking error in the up scenario and in the down scenario. So for example, is a tracking error better when things are up, or is a tracking error worsening when things are down? If it's worsening when things are down, it also says something about the liquidity in the time zone.
No, I think that makes lots of sense, but that, you know, that's a question that people will have. Hey, why should I not just buy it here when I, you know, can I get it from home instead of going abroad for that? But yeah, thanks. I think those are really good, you know, 5-6 points that we covered there of, you know, that people can take away today and actually, you know, start looking out for when they do make the decision to get into ETFs. So I think we covered quite a bit here in terms of, you know, history. You know, we talked about, we demystified some of the ETF bubble questions, and we help people understand where they can buy the ETFs and what they should consider when selecting an ETF. Maybe to bring it to a closed loop is, especially since we have Anthony here with us today, what does the future have in store for ETF investing? You know, what do you see out there in terms of the industry going towards? What are parts of the industry that are still, you know, being able to be unlocked that, you know, have not been touched by ETFs? Yeah, what do you see there?
Expansion. I think, you know, the ETF growth, we think, is going to kick on from where we are, and we project almost a doubling in assets by the end of 2023 to 12 trillion from, you know, the around six trillion that we have in the market today. But I think the coming trend, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, is really in sustainable investing. And we've seen that this year particularly. We've seen sustainable investing ETFs gather 15 billion, which, you know, is coming from quite a low base, but really accelerating in terms of their use. And that's really just, I think it's awareness of some of the issues that are, you know, like climate change affecting the planet, but it's also things like, you know, good governance of companies, and that's increasingly, you know, coming to the fore in ETF format, because, you know, retail investors have an increasing awareness of this, and, you know, want to do good with their investments as well, but they, you know, they don't want to sacrifice returns in doing so. And I think sustainable investing is now proving that it, you know, you can both do good and generate good returns.
Yeah, and then you mentioned sustainable investing, which then feeds into one of the trends that is happening also with people having an opinion about something they want to invest in. They want to not just invest to make, yes, they all want to make profit, right? But they also want to have a say in, you know, or want to feel good about their investment. With that comes thematics, right? And I think that is a topic that is gaining a lot of steam in the US. And in Europe, you can see a lot of, digital or like fintech companies that really are going after that market by offering thematic portfolios to investors, because maybe an investor likes to go into biotech, right? So we can make a theme around biotech and then pick the companies around that and put them in ETF. How do you see that thematic ETF development? Is that where a lot of the growth will be coming from? Not just the sustainable piece, but also different other themes?
We're certainly seeing a lot of growth in thematics. And I kind of touched on this point a little bit earlier that, you know, the greater ability that we have now to manipulate big data means that we can really drill down into supply chains and get much more granular in terms of the, sector exposures or themes, if you like, that people want to invest in. You know, for example, you can buy an ETF that looks at electronic vehicles, and it will look at, you know, the supply chains for electronic vehicles, or you can look at something like digital security. And I think what these themes do is really access emerging trends that are sort of driven by, you know, what are called mega trends. And that's, you know, how long people are living. People are living longer. It's an economic shift from, you know, Western world to the East, and rapid urbanization. We're seeing that particularly in developing countries. And then lastly, which is, you know, perhaps the most obvious, is, you know, increasing digitization and automation coming through in the economy.
Yeah, Freddie, is that something you're also tracking? What is your thought about thematics in terms of portfolio construction? Is this something you're thinking about? Is this, you know, something interesting to you as well?
Absolutely, and I've been monitoring the progress ETF as a whole is making in this space. It's up and coming, but not to a stage where we would do it in a big way. But I think in a couple of years, it's going to really take off, and there will be more options and alternatives in the space for sustainable investing, thematic investing, and even ESG, the environmental social governance thing, right? I mean, like, just to, as an example, right? I mean, governance could actually be an important factor, even for an investor, right? Just think about Toshiba Westinghouse example, right? Westinghouse has this long-term liability with decommissioning nuclear plants, and regulations have stepped up. So there's a potential legal liability, and that would be reflected in the stock price of the owner, Toshiba, the stock price, right?
Yeah.
And they did mismanage that a couple of times, got warnings in Europe all over, and that became a problem for the stocks, right? So as a factor, this really works to also sort of flag risk for investors. So the thematics, the ESG, the sustainable investing, if they are not too overvalued or already at a point in time, they could actually serve as risk diversifier for a multi-portfolio assets.
No, exactly. And, you know, just using the wave of trends too, right, to maybe for a few years adjust portfolios. I think there's some super interesting developments ahead over the next decade that we'll be witnessing. So thanks for giving an overview there, because I know especially, you know, for people, you know, 50 and above and below, actually, this is becoming, I see this come up a lot during webinars and seminars, you know, people asking, hey, can we offer more thematic portfolios? Because it's on people's mind, like Anthony said before, right? People think more sustainable nowadays. And it's really creating an industry within the ETF space, of how to allocate that capital to those areas. But so thank you both for that. Before we close up, I wanted to just hear, you know, a little bit of your parting words from both of you, maybe in terms of the next, let's call it the next decade, right? But people, you know, we've seen this in the US over the last decade that I was, you know, most of the decade I was in the US, and after the financial crisis, you know, people lost, there is no more or not many more defined benefit schemes around the world where people, you know, just put money in, the company allocated the capital, here is what you get out at the end, right? Here's your $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 retirement paycheck. That's not the norm anymore, right? And especially where I come from as well, in Germany, this is a lot of people are still relying on this, but companies, for like anyone going out of college nowadays, will not have access to these pension plans anymore. So the onus is on the individual, right? And I think this is where ETFs can play a pivotal role of helping people maneuver this. Is there anything that you want to say, you know, to the audience, kind of like as parting words of how they should be investing, or how you look into doing it for yourself in terms of securing your future?
Yeah, as you said, you know, really the end of a lot of these defined benefit schemes really does push the onus onto, you know, investors or, you know, general workers now to come up with a retirement solution themselves. Where ETFs really help with that is really the low cost. And you know, if you think your retirement portfolio is going to be in existence for, you know, a couple of decades or longer, hopefully, what you should see is that the, you know, that grows as much as it can. But and a key component for that to happen is minimizing the costs that you have in the portfolio, because costs have a, you know, once they get compounded year on year on year, really can significantly diminish returns over the longer term.
Yeah, you managed to squeak in there the fees, right? And the compounding of fees. And I think that's the one thing an investor can control, right? You can't control the market in the short term, but you can control your fees. And it's an important aspect of, you know, managing at least the part that you can control. Freddie, anything from you there?
Well, I'm going to, before I quote my favorite sentence of all time, I'm going to say that thanks to the ETF revolution, it has given us no excuses not to start early. So my advice is to start early, regardless of your age and wealth level. All those barriers are gone now because the minimum has come down, right? The fees have come down. The liquidity has gone up. The flexibility has gone up. And the amount of choices has also gone up. So there's no excuses not to start early anymore. So here's this. The power of compounding is the eighth wonder of the world, so said by Albert Einstein, my favorite physicist and person of all time. He's a physicist and he's talking about the expanding universe. But the same concept applies to investing too. The power of compounding. Well, start early.
Exactly. No, thank you so much, both of you. This was super insightful, today's episode. So thank you both very, 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 very much for being here and taking the time out of your day to do this for our audience. I'm sure we might have both of you on again because there's quite a bunch of topics that we could still cover when it comes to ETFs as well. But that's for the future. With that being said, I hope everyone enjoyed today again. Julie, give us your feedback. If what you want to hear more about, what do you want to hear about in the future? And we will be back with you again shortly. Thank you so much.
That's it for the show this week. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, subscribe and leave us a review. The reviews really help us, and we love reading your comments as well. In Your Best Interest is hosted by me, Philip Mutter. We're produced by Stashway, and we're mixed by Mo Ramley.